green plastic walls.
No famous author on today, although I'm working on it. I'm working on a big one.
Who is it? Salman Rushdie.
Bigger.
Philip Roth.
He's passed away.
Well, that'd be a huge get then.
That would be.
Yeah.
Well, let's leave it as a surprise, but...
I
mentioned it in the Discord, but...
Really?
Sign up at patreon.com/antifada if you want to see me tease out future guests.
I'm going to have to sign up for that shit, man. I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, so no big author on today, but we will take a look at the news of the world, which predictably is getting worse and worse leading up to the election.
You know, we do have a guest, though, a guest who had a short appearance on the episode about pirates and communism. That's Shug Pekingese.
Oh, Pekingese?
Yeah, the Pekingese.
The Shug Pekingese is here? The pirate Shug? Pekingese.
Yeah, she was barking all over the place last time. She's volunteered to do it again. So if you enjoyed that guest spot from Shug Pekingese, give a shout out in the comments to the good girl, to the nice Pekingese.
How do you imagine Shug sounding if you were to imitate her voice?
Oh, you don't think that we have a very advanced Shug voice? You never heard it before?
Maybe. I thought maybe that was the voice you used to talk to Shug.
Oh, I don't know. This is a little private, man. Maybe we can have to do that behind the paywall. I'll give you like a tiny little taste of it, because you have to understand this is a little dog, and she was bred to be like in the Imperial Palace, you know, like up on the throne. So she'd have to have a very like officious voice, a very imperious voice, and she'd have to be very smug. So she talks a little bit like, yes, I'm going to need some chicken today. Can you give me them?
I'm a Pekingese.
That's it. That's all you're getting. I could go for ages. We could do, if people like this sort of content, I can do like a whole bonus, like a 3-hour bonus of just Pekingese voice. So sound off, man. Sound off in the comments. We could do Peaky all day.
Sounds like a groveling jester of the royal court, maybe, or not a jester, just
some lesser
official, like a real sniveling, like could be cut at any moment type.
Yeah, like a Confucian bureaucrat sort of thing, you know?
I would think she's more like Queen Elizabeth towards the end.
Well, yeah, I hope Shug lives another 30 years. She's a really good girl. She's patrolling the area right now in the office where I'm recording to make sure there's no villains about. So thank you, Shug. Thank you for that.
I like when Shug's looking fluffy and alert. Go ahead.
Very alert and very fluffy. You were talking about the news, man. I don't know if you've been following this shit, but it's fucking terrible.
Yeah.
Doesn't get better, man. Every fucking day gets worse and worse.
Yeah, but, like, you know, I have been following... The main news I've been following closely for my other job is the Mets.
Yes.
And they just clinched the playoffs. But, you know, even the events of the world have not stayed hermetically sealed from the world of baseball, because they had to play a doubleheader today as a result of Hurricane Helene hitting the southeast.
Oh yeah!
Unfortunately, they won the first game of that series, and so they are heading to the playoffs. But the hurricane has wrought untold havoc in the South, and we're still getting a grasp on how fucked up it is.
I have relatives in Florida, of course, and everybody dodged the bullet. My mom was down there. They were vacationing down there. They had to get the hell out. Nobody I know has been affected, but it looks like Florida, you know, didn't get the worst of it. It was North Carolina and Tennessee. Terrible, terrible flooding. The footage is incredible.
Yeah, I was reading mostly about Asheville, which I think the only place that I've read about getting hit really hard that I've been to, because Asheville has had this reputation for a long time as like a retirement home of punks. There's certainly a lot of anarchists in that area.
Crusties.
And so, yeah, seeing the retired crusties, crusty retirement home. Yeah. And so seeing the scenes of like the arts district in Asheville flooded hit a little close to home, more than a lot of this disaster footage often does. And it's also interesting that it hit in Asheville, because this is a town that's been marketed by realtors and by local government as a climate proof zone. This is some of the rhetoric that's been used in areas of the country to try to attract real estate investment and attract industries moving in, claiming that, for example, Asheville, I think Atlanta also uses this rhetoric, and I think places in the Northwest as well. They're above sea level or they're not coastal.
Yeah.
Places that are elevated and temperate so they don't get too hot. Places with like a moderate amount of rainfall so there's not a chance of wildfire. Places with a good water reserve so there's not a chance of drought. Asheville checked all these boxes, and yet a massive hurricane strengthening at the last moment, hitting the East Coast, was enough to wash away roads, wash away mountainsides. Here's an article from USA Today. At least 100 people dead and over 2 million homes and businesses remain in the dark across the Southeast on Monday. Hundreds of water rescues have taken place across Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas. Tennessee and Virginia since Helene's brutal landfall. Atlanta totaled more than 11 inches of rain in 48 hours, smashing a record that stood for almost 150 years. Houses floated away from subdivisions, bridges crumbled, semi-trucks were tossed into mangled piles, mud, tree branches, and food from local grocery stores flowed into the streets. And in other cases, police guarded grocery stores to make sure people didn't
rob them. Yeah, that was floating around. You had people searching for any sort of supplies, for fresh water, for food, and cops at the making sure there was no looters there. Priorities, right?
And so the response from the federal government has been the standard. FEMA is going to come in. National Guard and other forces have been mobilized to do rescues and that sort of thing. But here's Biden making a kind of unfortunate statement about it.
It really is amazing. You saw the photographs. It's stunning.
It's unbelievable. It really is.
Such a wide area.
And we've given them all everything that we have. We're on the ground ahead of time. So we're working hard.
So he says, we've given them everything we have. And then the reporter asks, are there any more resources the federal government could be giving them?
No, we've given them, we have pre-planned a significant amount of it.
And he says, no. So it's strange to me because North Carolina is a swing state, Georgia is a swing state. You think these would be the moments when the federal government would be giving them everything they have and then also being very careful about what kind of rhetoric they're using. And for him to say, we've given them everything already, and there's nothing more to give.
Yeah.
Even if what he means by that is like, you know, help is on the way, it just takes time. It's not bad, not good, man. Optics.
No, it was. There's this, which is still very much ongoing. As you said, there's people without power. There's people who are flooded out. There's also that. What was it? That East Palestine, Ohio, chemical explosion.
Yeah, there was one in Conyers, Georgia had a chemical explosion, which as far as I can tell is unrelated to the hurricane. I mean, it might have had something to do with like lack of staff or something as a result, but there was a sprinkler system shorted out and lit a fire and the whole place went up. And I think there's chlorine gas just wafting all over Georgia.
That's not
right
good.
Now,
we're trained to know chlorine gas bad. And since World War I, we've known chlorine gas bad for people.
Yeah, what happens if you get a big whiff of chlorine gas?
Your brain goes swimming, I guess. You're pretty much cooked, man. I think it burns your lungs, but don't quote me on that. It's bad stuff.
Okay.
There was Hurricane Maria in the Gulf, and then famously, too, of course, almost 20 years ago, Hurricane Katrina. It feels as though in our lifetimes, state capacity for disaster relief has declined considerably. There's the very, when Biden goes out there and says there's no more money, there's no more resources, the easy quip, and you'll see this a lot on social media, is, well, all that money went to Israel and Ukraine, you know, for war, which I'm not sure is strictly true, but it does, I think, pose a good rhetorical point. If anything, right, which is like the priorities of the Biden administration and the government right now, is it disaster relief or is it ensuring that like the Azov battalion gets extra, I don't know what, anti-aircraft missiles?
Well, I mean, it'll likely be the case that if FEMA does have any shortfall as a result of this, they'll pass extra billions to give, just as they would for Israel when if Israel asks for extra money.
What they could do is they could bring Bibi Netanyahu over to have another big speech at the UN, or maybe invite him to the White House, get him like a speech in front of both houses of Congress, like great applause, and convince him that Hurricane Helene is Hamas, right? And then have Israel maybe do like a massive campaign to try to, I don't know, relieve the suffering.
Well, Trump might finally get his dream of nuking a hurricane.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Which, you know, people make fun of him for that, but who's to say it wouldn't work?
No,
you don't know. It's untested.
He's an innovator.
We've got plenty
of
nukes.
Outside of the box.
But I think, you know, no matter how good or bad compared to other relief efforts, it is right now, like, people are struggling and scared and stranded. And it looks, first of all, terrible that the Biden administration and Harris are not running on the parts of their agenda that were aimed at resiliency and infrastructure improvement and climate change and that sort of stuff. They don't really mention it. In fact, they sort of run to the right on it with, you know, Harris running from the fact that she was once against fracking.
Right.
And in fact, on Friday, when the hurricane was just passing and the disaster was first making itself known, she was at the border talking about how we're going to tighten restrictions on asylum seekers, prosecute asylum seekers who cross the border illegally, and generally, you know, trying to use Trump optics and Trump rhetoric at the same moment, while, you know, also on Friday, Israel launches its second wave of a multi-wave assault on Lebanon, expanding the war. Yeah. So, you know, really, it's hard. No matter what the financial situation is, the way the government manages crises, whether it be the Middle East, whether it be natural disasters or climate change in general, is like, well, let the crisis happen, and then we'll try to do our best to manage it bureaucratically.
Yeah.
And well, I think that's really bad rhetoric.
Yeah, obviously when they do the tough on crime border rhetoric, the Democrats kind of tailing Trump on that stuff. We know that there's climate refugees, mass climate refugees coming down the pipe on top of all the economic refugees and political violence refugees from Central and South America. You know, the last few jobs I've been working on, and in fact, for the last like 12, 13 years, a lot of the jobs I've been working on have been resiliency from either the previous hurricane or the most recent batch of Biden money, you know, to do resiliency projects. New York City, with all that massive real estate, massive economy, it's got finance, it's got the media, it's got giant ports or whatever, gets billions of dollars. Like, I'm on a multi-billion dollar resiliency project right now with like flood walls and all that, in order to make sure Manhattan doesn't get inundated over the course of the next hurricane, or just, you know, the rising of the oceans. I'm not entirely sure that Appalachia or parts of the Pacific Northwest, or maybe Asheville, will get some good resiliency funding. So it's like a known place for the coastal elite. You know, they have got a little bit of juice. But I think that there's going to be an uneven, very uneven geographical spread with the places that get A, resiliency, and B, get rebuilt in any sort of way. I'm not saying that money won't go into these poor Appalachian communities in North Carolina or Tennessee or West Virginia. It's just that I think we know there's going to be an uneven geography.
One other thing about resiliency I was thinking about with this is Cop City, because of course there was major flooding in Atlanta as well. And one of the major talking points that Stop Cop City brought up is that they're trying to save this forest, not only because they're against the concept of Cop City and this sort of thing, but because that that forest, which they call Wilani, I think, the largest green space in Atlanta. And so places like that soak up a lot of rainwater. They're really helped to prevent flooding. And so Atlanta recently, sort of bragging about their progress on Cop City, posted a short video of the work on the site so far, which is they've built a huge like paved area in the the place they've clear cut, and they're just having cops and fire department and EMS doing test drives on there, like, you know, just driving in circles, doing donuts, that sort of thing. It's like sort of demonstrating the point of the more ecological wing of Stop Cop City, which is that if you pave away these forests, these areas of soil and greenery, you're just going to make the areas around the proposed Cop City site, which are largely poor and working class areas, more prone to flooding.
Look at Houston. Whenever there's a large storm in Houston, you see the ill effects of their zoning and their lack of resiliency, because basically the entire thing, the way the city has been built, is just a giant bowl of concrete. And so the water's got nowhere to go. You know, one other thing I would bring up about this this disaster is obviously it affects like hundreds of people are injured or dead, and you've got all sorts of damage to people's lives and livelihoods. There's also, of course, like an economic component. So it's not just FEMA in charge of dispersing monies and sending resources. It's, of course, also private insurance. And if you're in a place like Florida, public insurance, flood insurance, the amount of claims they're estimating region-wide for this hurricane is anywhere between $65 and $110 billion.
Oh, my God.
Which is just an incredible amount of money. The Florida flood insurance, weather insurance market has already been in crisis. I don't know if you've been following this, but it's basically completely unaffordable to get a new flood insurance policy in Florida at this point. There was a public option that they put in, I think maybe after Hurricane Andrew, so like the late 90s. That was like a last ditch, like a stopgap measure for people who couldn't get private insurance. But that fund is terribly, terribly depleted. So even like the private markets, the private insurance markets and the refinance insurance markets are going to have a tougher and tougher time dealing with this, with disasters of this intensity and you know, this strength moving forward. So it's another thing to look at too, which is it's not just a crisis of public life, you know, to see massive swaths of the country destroyed by these ever increasing storms, but it also could potentially see next time massive insurance companies going under and all the consequences of that. People remember AIG was one of the main players in the 2008 financial crisis. Because they were a big insurance group that went under. So also something to look at when these things happen.
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, you're just not going to be able to get that kind of insurance throughout large sections of the country. And these are also areas that are, the populations are booming. And
yeah,
Houston and Florida and around Atlanta.
And South Carolina, North Carolina, like there's a lot of the guys that I work with who are older in their 50s and looking towards retirement. Almost all of them are going to like South Carolina these days because Florida's full. So Florida is now full of like newly retired people, older people who have been there for 20, 30 years, and younger people who go there to work in like the service industry or construction or whatever it is that's going on down there. Well, more and more it's full, right? They don't have as much land that they can develop anymore. And now all of a sudden the private insurance market is in absolute crisis. So Florida will be interesting to watch over the next 15, 20 years.
But I did want to tie this somehow to both what's happening in the Middle East. You know, Israel, after striking Lebanon, also continued striking the Houthis in Yemen, or really not striking the Houthis so much as the Yemeni population as collective punishment against the Houthis. And then also the upcoming longshore workers strike. Yeah. And I thought, well, how can we tie these all together? And fortunately, here's another clip from Joe Biden, who's doing that for us.
He's tying it all in.
Mr. President, will you deploy more U.S. troops to the Middle East?
Mr. President, has Netanyahu gone too far?
Any comment on the strikes in Yemen, Mr. President?
He's incredible brain on this man.
So this is him getting out of an SUV about to go on a plane, and he's just walking slowly and like He looks terrible. I mean,
it's like dog shit.
In case you didn't make that out, the reporter says, any comment on the strikes in Yemen? And Biden says, I've spoken to both sides. They got to settle the strike. I'm supporting the collective bargaining effort. I think they'll settle the strike.
I said something about Biden that his brain went there like immediately, right? I guess since his foreign policy is in absolute fucking tatters, Benjamin Netanyahu and Ben-Gavir just running roughshod over whatever interests, you know, in some sort of calm and consensus and ceasefires in the Middle East, allegedly that Biden's administration is trying to do. Given that his foreign policy is a smoking pile, heaping pile of dog shit right now, he, of course, his brain immediately goes to something that he could potentially handle. He could sit down and help mediate between the contractors and the International Longshore Association. He could even, you know, demand through Taft-Hartley that they have an 80-day cooling off period. So Joe Biden, you know, as any disabled person is doing, he's just trying to manage what he can manage, you know, in the time that he has left in the presidency and on this world.
Well, he might have just misheard the question.
No.
It is hilarious that he heard strike and he's like, well, you know, he's kind of like us, I guess. He hears strike. He thinks, oh, yeah, there's a strike coming up. So
he thinks, viva la proletariat, dude.
But the strike he's probably thinking of, like you said, is the longshoremen's strike on the East Coast ports. There's 45,000 members that are, I think, going to strike tonight or tomorrow if there's no deal reached.
It'll by the time this comes out, it'll be like the day after the strike is to have begun.
Yeah. And so reading from an article from Reuters, they could shut down 36 ports from Maine to Texas that handle about half the goods shipped into and out of the United States. West Coast dock workers belong to a different union that aren't involved in the strike. We've covered that in previous episodes. The union is demanding significantly higher wages and a total ban of on the automation of cranes, gates, and moving containers in the loading and unloading of freight. Mm. And then there's some really interesting quotes in this article that kind of give it a war on Christmas type vibe. I think this person,
a flashback to 2 years ago when almost the exact same thing happened. With the railroad strike.
I think we covered it too. So the Toy Association, the nation's leading toy trade group,
they're going to take away the children's toys for Christmas.
They represent the Santa Clauses of the world who command all the elves to make the toys. Right. They were among the 200 organizations that asked Joe Biden in a letter this month to work with both sides to reach an agreement. And the article also goes into this one person who's an importer of fake Christmas trees. And he's terrified about these fake Christmas trees not coming in on time.
What would we do without our fake Christmas trees? I tell you.
And then another interesting kind of like literary motif in this article, they talk to another guy who imports like AstroTurf, like fake grass. So there's a weird like plastic naturalism in this article that's under threat by this
fake
strike.
Plastic watering can. Radiohead, no.
Okay, it's like plastic trees. Yeah, that'll be a good song for the episode.
Yeah, there you go.
You're welcome. But yeah, maybe if those elves hadn't unionized against automation, this wouldn't have been an issue. But there's also a Yemen tie-in in this article. It says, a longshoreman strike would further distress a global supply chain that has already endured slowdowns from attacks by Yemen's Houthi rebels on commercial shipping. Those attacks have all but shut down the use of the Red Sea and Suez Canal, said Jonathan Gold, vice president of supply chain and customs policy at the National Retail Foundation. The attacks are forcing longer transit times for vessels that must navigate around the Cape of Good Hope to reach the East Coast and Gulf Coast ports. It's interesting that they say, well, the supply chain's under stress because of this war in the Middle East, but the real threat here is the workers going on strike.
Yeah. No, I mean, especially in the United States, workers aren't supposed to do that. The as I understand it, the port of Eilat, which is the largest Israeli port on the Red Sea, is like officially in bankruptcy. They've seen barely any ships, for obvious reason, for the last like 6 or 7 months or so. It's having a tremendous effect on the Israeli economy. It's incredible to imagine they could keep on going on like this much longer. But You know, there's the longshore strike on the East Coast would be huge. 50% of American cargo all the way from Maine down to the Gulf and the Texan ports. You know, this is the time to strike, so to speak. Strike while the iron's hot. The amount that longshore workers put up with during the COVID disaster was incredible. The fact that they're still making like 40 something dollars an hour is pretty interesting in this day and age. I think that the automation stuff is what really blows the right wing and the left, like the neoliberal left's heads open, because this idea that you would stop the automation, stop the efficiency, stop the productivity there is obviously anathema to not just the way that like ideologically they understand the world and what's right and good in terms of the movements, the flows of goods and commodities throughout this unglobalizing world right now. But, you know, other workers who have failed this in, say, Amsterdam or Rotterdam, I should say, have these incredibly automated ports where computers do all the work and machines do all the work. And there's just like sort of people tending them, making good money, but there's only like 10 or 15 of them for a port. I over-exaggerate, but you know what I mean. You know, there's automation is automation. I can't begrudge these workers for saying, no, don't put us out of our jobs. Containerization itself already absolutely decimated these unions. And so you have like, you know, some thousands worth of workers left in there. And if they got to defend their fucking work, I say, let them defend it, man. It's not that goods don't get moved in and out of those ports. They get moved just fine. The feather bedding that went on in the era of containerization was to get like bonuses based on how like the value of cargo moved in and out as a supplement to wages. So maybe at the end of the day, there'll be some automation because of course this is a bargaining position, but hopefully if the workers are smart, they'll feather bed themselves and get like more bonuses based on how much they move, which should make up for hopefully some of the job losses.
Yeah, and the short term for the current workers, so there's always going to be the specter of like a two-tiered system in the future where future longshoremen are descaled to some degree or are more expendable. I think this is another thing that we did cover 2 years ago when we talked about the a longshore strike back then. But yeah, usually these aren't just like kind of Luddite campaigns against automation, but a way to negotiate their implementation.
Right.
But in general, I think the longshore workers here and in other countries are really cognizant of how much power they have and how much international capital wants to decrease that power. So there aren't threats of strikes that could damage things that are really important to the American economy, like artificial trees at Christmas.
Right. And AstroTurf. Yeah. The of course, the logistics sector, as it's called now, or like transportation sector, the movements of goods and commodities. Still, as you know, in the very beginning of this podcast, we were talking about Amazon and we were talking about these workers. We still are because, of course, they have this sort of central place, nodal place within the global capitalist economy. You also saw this week, based on, I think, an NLRB ruling against Amazon, that 8 different shops of Amazon truck drivers out of Queens voted to unionize with the Teamsters this week. So these things are all connected, right? And I think that even in like the capitalist core of the sectors of the working class that are most internationally oriented, I think those tend to be port workers and transportation workers in general. Because when you see the like blockading of goods for apartheid in Palestine, the blockading of goods to military and right-wing regimes, those tend to be, you know, Taiwanese, Japanese, American, Indian longshore workers because of this deep, almost structural internationalism that's kind of built into it. The ILWU, of course, out west is the radical, formerly communist-run union, but the ILA, being like a business craft union, still has that sort of mentality just based on what the trade is, what the work is.
And I think a commonality between all these things we've talked about so far is, yeah, the rhetoric coming out of the people in power, which is sort of veering ever towards this like highly nationalist, highly protectionist strategy of increasing border militarization, increasing the militarization of police. In Israel's case, it's just pure, if you defy us, we will crush you and everyone around you. Life no longer has any value in the case of Israel's military operation. Their rhetoric is they've abandoned all pretense of like being the moral army of the world or something like that. They knocked down this whole neighborhood of apartment buildings to get to Nasrallah, and they claim like, oh, we sent a text to everybody to get out, but this was in the middle of the night, and I think the text actually came after the first round of bombings.
Yeah, of course.
So there's and people who defend this stuff, they say like, well, Hezbollah was sending rockets to northern Israel. Northern Israeli settlers had to flee back to other parts of the country. And if you strike Israel, we're going to strike you back. And incredibly, the point of those strikes was to pressure a ceasefire in Gaza.
Mm.
And
of the Hezbollah strikes against Israel, right?
And so I think
it was when the alleged story is that when they Netanyahu and his ghoulish regime figured out that Nasrallah and company were serious about no ceasefire until the destruction of Gaza ends, that's when they decided, well, this guy's too much. We got to knock him off.
Right. That's definitely how it appears. And they obviously it's a campaign long in the making because they were able to do that truly horrific pager attack.
The terrorist attack. Yeah. I felt when I found out what they did, the Netanyahu using a highly belligerent warmongering speech at the UN as cover for a covert like assassination operation and terror operation in Beirut, with like after the terrorist attack with the pagers and after all the various different assassinations, the bombing of Houthi ports, the bombing of civilians like all over that region, when it came down that they had really crossed that Rubicon, I started to think very differently about this conflict in the Middle East, because it seemed like, reports are that Nasrallah and others within Hezbollah seemed to believe that there was some sort of like low intensity back and forth between the IDF and Hezbollah and Iran and the IDF, and that Gaza, of course, being absolutely obliterated and knocked down to the ground and tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people dying, was like a continuation of the sort of apartheid, brutal strategy that Israel has used for a while, just in extremis. But when I saw what they did with Nasrallah and that assassination and terror bombing thing, I thought to myself, this is different. This is like the worldview we saw in like 2003. This is like everybody talked about the neocons back then. This is like trying to change facts on the ground, like make a huge geopolitical play to like actually break out of, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 years of back and forth between like Axis of Resistance or like PLO or Iran back proxies or whatever. There was like a certain modus vivendi in that area. But the strikes on Hezbollah, I think, go to show that we're in a whole different ball game now. Like the Israeli, the ghouls in Israel have decided to like make this the final fight against these people. And if that means leveling South Lebanon to the ground, if it means occupying Lebanon up to Beirut, if it means exacting upon the people of Lebanon the same sort of physical destruction and liquidation and utter destruction and catastrophe that they've done to Gaza, if they need to do that to Lebanon, they're going to go ahead and do it. And I think that they even, and you've seen them pushing and pushing and pushing with this warmongering and this escalation, I think they want an all-out war with Iran. They want to finish this fucking thing. And that's like different. I think the last year something has shifted and the real like psychopaths, the real, I'll call them fascists because I think they are the real fascists within Israel, are in the driver's seat right now. And they're looking at like a new order in that region in a way that maybe we haven't seen in my lifetime.
Yeah, I think it is very similar to the Bush administration after the terrorist attacks, where you have the entire country supporting just whatever revanchist war would come next. And then the sort of difference is that, like, yeah, there's marginal mass support for Iraq. It was like 60-40 or something like that, 65-35. But pretty quickly, U.S. public lost interest in that war. Support for the war is kind of revealed to be a quagmire. Why I don't think that's going to happen here, why I think Netanyahu's support has jumped up from just a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about these mass protests throughout Israel,
yeah,
is because there's this greater Israel promise to this. Like, yeah, obviously there was promise of like, well, the U.S. will control oil markets in Iraq or something, but that's a little bit abstract for U.S. people. I think Netanyahu's base is very happy with the prospect of settling in Gaza and settling in Lebanon and taking the West Bank, turning the West Bank into a new Gaza, and just, you know, seeing this process sort of shift towards like this kind of overt fascist moment. And so what I was thinking about in terms of like the way the U.S. is managing this crisis, not only Harris going to the border and talking about, you know, crushing the climate refugees trying to get across, mm-hmm, while cities like Atlanta and Asheville, which were supposed to be havens for climate refugees, drown. But another piece of rhetoric that Harris put out this week was attacking Donald Trump for his tariffs, specifically about how it'll affect tequila prices. This is an article from Rolling Stone. Team Harris turns to alcohol to get young people to care about Trump's tariffs. One TikTok produced by the campaign features a young man warning that the Trump tequila tax is insane and that a 20% tax on all imported goods means he wants to tax your tequila and your Coronas and your Modelos, your Hennessy, all of it.
Doesn't most of it come from Mexico, dude? Like, don't we have a whole separate agreement for that? They're really going to put tariffs up on Mexico and Canada? All right.
Well, maybe that's what Trump has said.
It's your economy, man. Do what you want. Hennessy is at least France, but like,
right,
I haven't looked into Trump's plans at all. But,
well, there's a little bit of ethnic pandering going on there with like, oh, the, you know, your Modelos and your Hennessy,
right?
But yeah, that whole talking point kind of strikes me as like, look, things are really bad, but under Trump, it's going to be more expensive to get wasted.
Right.
And that's kind of like, it sort of reminds me of like the way marijuana is being legalized everywhere, to the extent that even Trump is now saying that he supports decriminalization or something like that.
My understanding is that the Trump campaign has really isolated men, and not just white men, but men of any race between the ages of 18 and 35 as not their base per se, but as like their hinge point for winning this election, right? They think if they can get enough with like the macho rhetoric and like the manly and the tariffs and the reindustrialization, you know, what do they call it? A new industrial America sort of policy, that they can win enough like younger men in order to win the election. So I have to imagine that Harris probably doesn't think she can get too many of these guys, but at least like throwing like you won't be able to get wasted as easily under Trump might disorient them and demoralize them enough that they won't actually go out and vote on election day, because that's what it's all about, right? It's about like getting your base, getting fucking some like 2 or 3% of some small marginal constituency to vote in like the right districts. But you know, the whole thing is kind of moot if Harris and company get absolutely massacred in fucking Michigan because of the large Lebanese and Palestinian American population, which is watching like their home countries that they emigrated from, or their parents emigrated from, or their grandparents emigrated from, turn into fucking rubble and dust with American bombs and American weapons.
Yeah, but my point in bringing this up is that the people who are really affected by these crises and understand that the government's no longer interested in solving these things or preventing them, but just talking about managing them. And maybe you'll see some results down the line at some point, like you'll see some kind of mop up. The promise that they're giving these people is you can get drunk. We'll stop illegal immigration. We're going to increase the power of the police in the state. We'll put more people in prison.
We'll get cheap legal reefer.
And yeah, I mean, like, there's obviously, I think the Harris might squeak it out. Like, I think she's got a strategy here that could narrowly work, but this can only lead to a deeper delegitimization of the state as a means of managing problems, which will lead some people more towards kind of individualist free market thinking. It'll lead other people towards total nihilism and total disinterest in the political process. And anything else would be disillusionment. And it's interesting that Harris isn't even trying to run on making things better or making things more efficient or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be living off that Biden money for like probably the rest of my career. I'll still have some of that sweet Biden money coming down the pipe at me for resiliency and transport and infrastructure or whatever. So that's nice for me, I guess. It's good. And for like the few thousand people in my local. But like, yeah, what are they offering? Not all that much. They're offering a continuation of U.S. policy in the Middle East. Continuation of U.S. policy in Ukraine. The Middle East has gotten away from the Biden administration. It seems like if you believe what you read in the news, and by that I don't mean like the headlines and like the bombings and like I believe like the basic facts of the region. But if you read the Financial Times or certain stuff in the New York Times or stuff in foreign policy, stuff in The Economist or whatever, you sometimes get a little peek behind the scenes. And what like the blob understands the situation to be is that the United States has lost all of its influence, all of its power over Israel, and completely delegitimized its own soft power and hard power across the entire Arab world and many, many parts of the global South in general. An unmitigated absolute disaster, of course, giving Netanyahu a blank check. And then like maybe tutting on the sidelines as he wipes out hundreds of thousands of people and just basically does genocide to the Palestinian people and now soon to be the Lebanese people and maybe, of course, the Houthis, too. And if a war breaks out with Iran, all fucking bets are off. You have that. And Harris, I don't think actually would be as bad as Biden, because Biden has been for 50 years like one of the most bloodthirsty hawks of all when it comes to defending any time that Israel decides to wipe out entire swaths of civilians. He was supporting that shit back in the 1980s. And he, of course, supports it even more wholeheartedly now that he's the president. Harris, I don't know how strongly she feels about it, except that, like, of course, she needs the votes that come from supporting Israel, blah, blah, blah. But the real difference, I think, is in fucking Ukraine. You know, I don't know if you've been following the news in the war in Ukraine, but it's looking fucking dire right now. And the question is, if Harris wins and she continues Biden's policies, how much more manpower and morale does Ukraine have left to even fight by the time November, December comes? And if Trump wins, like, is he serious in his sort of J.D. Vance, like, dissident right type rhetoric about actually sitting down and negotiating with Russia and Ukraine and getting peace over in that region? The stuff in the Middle East is like horrifying and visceral. Ukraine's been going on for a bit longer. I guess we're coming up on 3 years pretty soon. The thing about Ukraine is the way in which Biden and Zelensky and all those fucking ghouls keep skirting up to the edge of global thermonuclear war, looking over the edge and be like, huh, well, yeah, I guess that might be bad. Maybe we won't let what like strikes on Russian territory that might look like a decapitation strike with a nuclear missile, you know, Biden, like that can only be done by NATO or American troops using their GPS coordinates and their ability to plug these things into long range.
Well, he hasn't talked about using nuclear missiles.
Oh,
Zelensky.
No, no, no. It's not like that. You have to understand that Soviet doctrine and American doctrine is such that if long range missiles or intermediate range missiles from a nuclear armed adversary, or even including F-16s, that was why Russia pushed back so much about the F-16s, because they can be nuclear armed. If one of those missiles starts flying towards Moscow, if you're in the Russian military and the air defense, you have 7 minutes to decide whether that's trying to strike like an oil facility nearby Moscow, or if it's a 10 megaton nuclear bomb going to blow up the fucking Kremlin and wipe out the leadership. So they have 7 minutes to decide whether to fire off all their nukes or not. Like, this is real shit. Like, it's not to like apologize for their regime, or it's not to say that like this is how the world should be, but this is how the world fucking is. And so over and over and over, whenever they talk about the red lines, American leadership and especially European leadership is walking directly up to that line, which is a nuclear line, which is like mushroom clouds over London, Berlin, Paris, New York, Washington, D.C., the end of humanity. And they're just kind of whistling past the graveyard on it.
Well, and I think in terms of Russia, Ukraine, things are a little bit more stabilized. You know, that could change at any moment. Like, Putin obviously has been saber rattling about nukes since the beginning of the war, since before that. But I think that there's a better sense within the security apparatus of like what the red lines are and how not to cross them and what to do if they are crossed. With Israel, it's a different story because Netanyahu's playing a kind of a different game. And I you know, the way Biden talks about it and the way the security apparatus talks about it is like, we can't stop him from doing anything. He does whatever he wants, and we just have to kind of like support it and try to make things don't get any worse, and then they get worse and worse. I think with in Ukraine, like, I think it's kind of a non-issue in the election because Trump's promise is like, I'll end it immediately, and Harris is saying like, well, that means you're going to surrender. But I think the conclusion of this will just be the same either way. Like, there's going to have to be some sort of negotiated territory transfer, and it might happen a little bit later under Harris than under Trump, but I don't think there's any major difference there.
I think that awaits to be seen, to be honest with you. I feel like the people who are truly willing to sacrifice, to fight to the last Ukrainian are in the blob, and are highly represented within like the new Democratic Party, the post realignment Democratic Party, which includes Dick Cheney and company. Right. And I think that, like, I'm not saying that Trump is a peacemonger or that J.D. Vance is right in his takes on that war, but I think you have a better chance maybe of less Ukrainians and Russians dying if maybe Trump becomes president instead, which looks unlikely nowadays. It's just it's a hypothetical. It's speculation at this point in time, but I think 2 weeks ago, we were about as close to nuclear war when I think it was when the UK and Estonia and others were basically pushing for those Storm Shadow missiles to be starting to be used to attack Russia. We were very close to a nuclear war, and I don't like that. That's no good. That's no good for me. That fucks up a lot of my plans.
Yeah, well,
I also floated the idea recently that if anyone's going to break the nuclear taboo, it's going to be Israel. I could see circumstances.
Yeah, where probably.
Israel fires off a nuclear weapon. Easy. If a full-scale war with Iran breaks out, right now the nuclear facilities are too deep to hit with bunker buster missiles. I could see not only Israel using a small nuclear weapon to blow up those nuclear facilities in Iran, but America even giving cover for them to do that. And that opens up the Pandora's box. Now you can use nukes and it's not mutually assured destruction. It's just another weapon of war.
Yeah, I think you're right that, yeah, like, this is what I was saying basically, is that Israel's got more of the fascist death drive than Putin does. Putin, I think, is really wedded to this. He's got very fascistic tendencies. He's hyper-nationalistic. he sees Russia as having a historic purpose and a destiny and all this stuff. And so does Israel, but they've got this, I don't know, they're at like sort of a different stage of that process. Say like
they're in the messianic.
Very end of days type thinking of
feeling very kind of Hitler,
like
right,
kind of like Hitler in the Fuhrer bunker. It's like, either we die or they die. And it doesn't really matter either way.
And that's a long time thing. I mean, did you ever read the book, The Samson Option by,
I'm familiar with The Samson Option. I haven't read much more than the Wikipedia entry.
Seymour Hersh. I read the Seymour Hersh book some years ago, and all the way back to the 1960s and 70s. It's, if Israel's existence was threatened, as Putin said literally, like, I am the leader of Russia, and what's the world worth if there isn't a Russia around? So we'll just basically nuke everybody and humanity is over. You know, it's the same thing with Israel. They wouldn't fire their limited nukes. They have like 60 or 70 nukes just at Tehran and Baghdad and Jeddah and these places. It's also Paris and Berlin and London and the United States. It's like, it's about like pulling the temple down around your head.
Literally in their case. And yeah. I think, either way, even if these conflicts end without nuclear war, the fact that you're seeing more and more fascistic lunatics getting into power and doing whatever they can, just like, complete, you know, we're like getting back to our episode with Anselm Yappi and his book about narcissism a few years ago. When you get these narcissists into power, eventually there will be this option for somebody in the U.S. or Russia or Israel or another country, North Korea, you know, China.
Yeah. Iran.
Well, I think Iran is a long way off from a nuclear missile. That's part of the lie of this whole thing. It's like they don't really have the capacity to make one and don't really have a chance to. As long as this current social order continues to proliferate with this law of the jungle mentality, the way it does, there's going to be a nuclear Armageddon. So we've got to stop it. But it could be
India versus Pakistan.
Sure. Yeah, that's always on the table.
Always on the table.
Psycho fascist is in charge in India as well. Yeah. But I wanted to shift to a couple more fun things.
Can I just finish off like on that topic with a little soapbox thing?
Okay.
Like, I think you and I mentioned maybe in our last news episode, I was talking about like the Popular Front, and I was talking about how, you know, you see there's like this vital center, which is trying to hold on to like norms and try to hold on to democracy and the rules-based international order. When things get wild and wacky and fucking scary like they are right now, and trust me, I spent a lot of time reading and listening about this stuff and thinking about this stuff, and it's absolutely terrifying. It should be terrifying for all of us. It's very tempting to say Harris Waltz 2024. Like, it's at least keep the adults in charge. Donald Trump is like a centrifugal force. It's only going to make things more chaotic. It's going to make a nuclear exchange more probable. I think that's actually not true, but whatever. So there's like an easy tendency, I think, for us to like want to put our hands athwart history and yell stop and be like, we have to hold on to the 1990s forever. Understandable, totally understandable. And if people want to vote Harris Waltz for that reason, more power to you, right? But like, there's at a certain point in time, we need to stop being conservative in that way and understand that like capitalism, this social system we have, is far more radical than most of us are, far more radical than the left is. That like massive changes are coming down the pipe, and not all bad ones, just things are going to be different, right? Are we willing to be as radical as capitalism? Are we willing to like jump into the darkness and say like, fuck Harris Waltz and fuck Trump, right? That none of these capitalist forces are going to be able to be like a centralizing or centripetal force in this, right? They're only going to be centrifugal because of the political economy we have, the mode of production we have, the political economy that leads to such catastrophe and violence and genocide and ethnic cleansing and despair and nuclear exchanges potentially, right? There's only one force in the world that can do anything to stop all of that, and that's us. We don't put our faith in Donald Trump We don't put our faith in the blind forces of history. We have to put our faith in ourselves as the working class, because the working class in its global existence is the only force capable. We are the only force capable of transcending this social system and all the dangers that it puts in front of us. So don't despair. Organize, right? Understand that the only way out is through us, and that we need to do what we need to do in order to ensure that humanity doesn't go down the way that people, that Harris and Waltz and Netanyahu and Putin and Zelensky and all of us want to take us down, which is endless accumulation and endless destruction.
Well said. And I think we always kind of push that point. And so that's why I want to include a couple kind of funny stories about proletarian self-activity and the idiocy of the police. But now we're at about an hour, so maybe we can do that on the other side of the paywall. If you want to listen to it, please sign up on Patreon at patreon.com/theantifada. You can sign up for $5 or $10, and if you sign up for a yearly membership, you get a 17% discount, and we really appreciate that. Listen to it on the other side of the paywall at patreon.com/theantifada.
We'd love to see you there, folks. Thanks for listening.